this evening, Steve L. from Redondo Beach. Redondo Beach? Redondo Beach? Redondo Beach.
Steve Lamb, alcoholic. From some beach community somewhere in Southern California. That is apparently not even as pronounceability as anonymity, but that's cool. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. If you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were, I counted 16 or 17 people that stood up and identified themselves as alcoholics. Welcome. There's probably one or two of you that just couldn't do it, didn't want to do it. Everybody's got a job in AA. All right. Thanks, T. Appreciate that. I want you to know that you're welcome, and I have one hope and one prayer for you tonight, and that's that you're desperate. And I don't say that to be mean or cruel or heartless, although some of the guys that I sponsor occasionally accuse me of those traits. I say that because it's my experience. And that desperation, you're sitting there, and if you are desperate, I don't mean like a bad hair day. I don't mean you're thinking that this is not a good day. You're probably sitting there thinking, man, it's Saturday night in San Diego, and I'm sitting here listening to a bald fat man who's going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're probably thinking you'd like to make a break for it, but you're wedged in between a couple old timers, and you can't make it. And it feels like it probably sucks. And if you're new, it does. It sucks. My recommendation is that you lean into it. You embrace it. It's going to be 2 to 3 minutes of your story at one point in time. We've all gone through it. And the reason why I say I hope you're desperate is because that desperation will leverage into willingness. And that willingness will result in action. And that action will then turn into an experience. And with that experience, like Mark, good talk, Mark, you'll be able to stay here. You'll be able to stay here. My sobriety date is July 27th, 1996, and I've been consecutively sober since then. And I want you to know it wasn't by design, wasn't the plan, didn't want to come here, didn't want to get sober, certainly didn't want to stay sober, didn't much care for you at all when I got here. And I got a DUI. I used to drive drunk all the time. I thought I was quite good at it. The police in Orange County disagreed with me. And I got sentenced by the judge. And the judge sentenced me to go to 6 AA meetings in 6 months, which I thought was excessive. I really did. I mean, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd heard this vicious rumor that y'all don't drink in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to not drink, so I don't really want to go. So I held out for quite some time. I waited till I had 5 weeks left to do 6 AA meetings, which I'm not that good at math, but it's more than one a week. You know, it's a lot. You know, and I have a perception problem because I'm new, and I'm thinking I got a busy social calendar. I just don't know how I can possibly fit that in. And I'm from the Los Angeles area. Back then, there was a couple thousand meetings a week. Now there's probably 3,000 meetings a week. There's quite a few down here in San Diego. But it just seemed like an insurmountable task to ask me to do. And I didn't want to go. And I held out, and I went. And the first day, I got sober, and I stayed sober. And again, I didn't want to stay sober. I didn't want to get sober. For the new people, just to give you an idea of what it was like towards the end of my drinking, you're going to hear a lot of different drinking stories. I don't like to spend a lot of time on that, because I think it's more important to talk about recovery, like Mark talked about. But all the drinking stories are different, but the result is all the same. And I'm a trial lawyer by trade. So I have to prepare for trial. And the way I prepare for trial before I get here is I like to drink beer and shoot tequila. That's how I prepare for trial. I get all the files. I don't look at anything. You know, I don't open anything. But I lay it all out, and I drink beer and I shoot tequila. And it's like magic. I drink beer, I shoot tequila. The beer is kind of like a food group. And the tequila is like jet fuel. It's like an accelerant. It gets you there. And what happens in my mind's eye, I'm in the courtroom. And I pick a jury. I make an opening statement. I examine witnesses. I cross-examine witnesses. I get in all the evidence that I need. I exclude all the evidence that's bad. I make a closing argument. And it's brilliant, I'm telling you. It's brilliant. And all, the whole jury is nodding their heads, and they go, they're hardly out maybe an hour or so. They come back, they rule in my favor. All this goes well. The only problem is, the way I drink and shoot tequila, usually before the jury comes in, I go down. You know, I pass out. And I've done this many times, so what happens is I set four or five alarm clocks at 2 to 3 minute different intervals. Because one or two is not going to wake, it's just going to irritate me. But around the third or fourth one, I'll get up. So those go off in the morning, and I get up in the morning, and I shower and shave. I put on a suit and tie. And I'm not drunk, but I've got a lot of alcohol in me, and I go to court. And the particular morning that I'm thinking about, I'm picking a jury. And it's a commercial case. It's other people's money. I got a client from New York. He's a high finance guy, Brian. And we're picking a jury, and the judge is telling us, and he's really talking mainly to Brian and the other client. He's saying, look, you guys have mediated. You've tried to settle this for a while. It's you know, several million dollars at risk here, but it's just money. You guys should try to solve this because you're going to tie my courtroom up for 5 or 6 weeks. The only people that are going to make money are the lawyers, which I was in favor of, but apparently that was a negative. So Brian's talking to the other client, and I'm picking a jury, and they resolve the case. It's around 11:30 in the morning, and Brian is very happy. It's several million dollars to his favor, so he tells the judge is happy, he puts it on the record, and he releases us. And Brian looks at me, and he's pretty excited. He says, you know, Lamb, I know it's before noon, but it feels like we should celebrate. Do you want to have a drink? And I'm thinking, what a country. Yes, I totally want to have a drink. This is, you know, because I'm thinking I'm not going to be able to prepare. I'm not going to be able to do what I like to do till later on in the day. And now I'm going to do it before noon, and this guy's going to pay for it. I mean, this is a good deal. So we go down to the Grand Avenue Bar, which is on Grand Avenue in downtown L.A. It's right next to the Biltmore Hotel. It's kind of a high-end sports bar. Now, I drink primarily at home, but I'll go drink at bars. But the type of bars I like to drink in, you know, they have sawdust on the floor. They have that, you know, that faint eau de urine smell. You know, that just, it's an ambiance that I literally, it's really attractive to me. But this is a really nice bar. It's got like a mahogany bar top. And we walk in there, and Brian tells the bartender to get the bottle of cognac, this dusty bottle of cognac down from the back. He plops it on the bar. He takes out these two large brandy snifters. And he pours one fluid ounce in each one, one shot in each one. Now, when you put a shot in a tequila glass, in a shot glass, if you're a good bartender, you fill it to the top so that I got to lean over and, because you don't want to waste, right? But when you put a fluid ounce in a brandy snifter, you can hardly see it. I mean, it's kind of sad and lonely and desperate. And I can see kind of the gold shimmer against the glass. I know it's in there, but I'm looking because I want to make sure. And Brian's looking at me and goes, you've never had cognac before. I'm saying, no, I never. Now, I'm not stupid. He's buying. I'm drinking. But Brian says, look, it's really important. There's a whole process. There's a protocol to this. It's really important. What you want to do is you want to take this brandy snifter. You want to cup it in the palm of your hand so that the palm of your hand makes contact with the glass, and that will warm up the cognac. You twirl it around, you coat the glass, you warm up the cognac. That's important because that will release the bouquet. I'm thinking this is totally unnecessary with tequila. But again, he's buying, right? So he's, and then you twirl around, you want, when it's warm enough and it's got the right temperature, you want to bring it up to your nose. You don't want to snort it, you don't want to sniff it. You just want to allow the bouquet to waft into your nostrils. And I'm thinking, yeah, we're going to drink this, right? You know, I mean, and he's like, okay, then you back it down. And when you've really appreciated the bouquet, which I'm thinking is not going to take long, you know, you want to bring it up to your lips. You don't want to drink it. You don't even want to sip it. You just want to allow the cognac to drape across your palate. Now, by now, my teeth are itching. You know that? And I'm just kind of rocking back and forth. And my eyes twitching. You know, just in anticipation of this, because then he goes through the whole process and he shows me, and then he says, okay, Lamb, it's your turn. I'm like, my turn. I love my turn. It's my turn. And I twirl it around, you know, I coat the glass. It's pretty, I mean, how warm does it need to be, you know? So I bring it up because I'm going to let it waft, and bam, I shoot it, just like tequila, you know? And if you're new, there was no thought process. I didn't think this through. It just happened. It was just like magic, you know, and I looked at Brian looked at me. I don't know who was more surprised. And he says, man, you know, that's like a couple hundred dollars a shot. And so I just looked down and reverted to the alcoholic anthem. I said, I'm sorry. Can I have a beer? You know, so he's a gracious guy. I'm drinking beer. He's, you know, twirling with a cognac and doing his thing. And I have three or four beers. I'm not where I was the night before, but I'm getting there. And I'm feeling good. But Brian's really a gracious guy. He's generous. He says, pay attention. We'll do it again. He goes through the whole process again. I'm thinking, I got this. I got this. I can do it. I can do it. I got it. And I twirl around. Bam! And it's gone again, you know. And now he gives me the, hey man, that ain't right look. You know, I mean, that ain't right. I mean, he's never read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he knew in that instance that the man that he was drinking with was bodily and mentally different than him. I mean, there was no question in his mind. And he's, you know, he's shaking his head and he's going, good Lord. He goes, look, it was about 1 o'clock by then. He goes, I'm gonna go to the bathroom and then come back and I'm going to head back to the hotel, call the people back in New York. It's around 4 o'clock in New York. I'm going to tell them the good news. And I'm like, okay. So he goes to the bathroom. I'm sitting there. I'm minding my own business. I'm drinking my beer, and I look over, and I see his cognac. Bam! You know, I drink that, right? Yeah. Because he obviously does not know how to drink this stuff, right? So I go to the bathroom. I come back out, and Brian's pretty upset. He's arguing with the bartender because someone has stolen his cognac. I remind him that I'm a very proficient trial attorney. And I start cross-examining people, like T. I mean, look at that guy. You know he'd take it, but Brian's not stupid. He is what we like to refer to as an ex-client. He's leaving, and he's shaking his head, and he's thinking, this is ridiculous, and he walks out. Now, this is my chapter 3, if you're new. You know, this is my inability to control and enjoy my drinking, and this is my inability to stop when it's appropriate to stop. A normal person would think, this. I worked for a large international law firm at the time. I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to have some serious explaining to do. It's bad. My first thought, now I'm going to drink the way I want to drink. Yeah, let's get it on. I get a table. I start drinking beer, shooting tequila. Forget this cognac stuff. Beer, tequila. There's a lot of people, when they drink, they lose track of things, like eating. It's not my story. You know, I like a light snack, maybe a pizza or a couple cheeseburgers. Nothing too heavy, you know. And I eat that, and I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. And I don't mean to be gross and disgusting, but it's just part of my story. What happens is I start farting. Yeah. I know it's not an impressive skill set, but it's all you too, right, sir? Yeah, right. Yeah, the South will rise again. Yeah. And you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. I got this whole purple haze thing going on, and I'm thinking I got a whole symphony going on. And people are disgusted. You know, there's two women. They're looking at me in the corner, and because I have a perception problem, they're looking at me, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, they want me. I mean, you know, who wouldn't? You know, I probably just coughed up a chunk of pizza, but I can't see reality. And so I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. I'm barking them off, and I go to lift my leg to be particularly melodic. And I miscalculate. You've been there too, huh, sir? Yeah. Now, it's okay. I don't want to overreact here. I mean, this is the bad thing is it's happened before. I mean, I'm used to this. And what you do is you gotta act cool, man. Don't act like anything. Don't to pretend nothing's going on, right? And keep drinking your beer. And keep that cheek cocked, because you don't want to make contact. And then you just kind of slide off on one cheek, you know. And then I go into the bathroom, I take off my jacket, I take off my pants, I take off my drawers. I clean myself up, I rinse my drawers out, you know. And there's some guy like you, and he's at the sink, and he's looking at me going, and I'm like, hey man, don't you practice hygiene? I mean, come on, man, you know, it's could have happened to anybody, you know. And I go back in the stall, and I take my jacket and my pants off. I put my soggy drawers back on, because I got some class. Not a lot, but I got some, and I put my jacket back on. I'm walking back out in the bar, and because I got a perception problem, I'm thinking, that went well. You know? And they're kind of damp, so I'm feeling kind of sexy, you know? I later learned that's what we call a delusion. You know, and I stay there. They wind up throwing me out. I drive home, and I drive drunk again. I love driving drunk, and I park in the driveway. My driveway, your driveway. I'm an equal opportunity driveway kind of guy. I don't care whose driveway it is. I go through the front door. The front door doesn't have a doorknob. It's the garage door. There's no way I'm getting a key in a keyhole. It is never going to happen. So I just push. I don't park it. The door goes up, and I walk in, and the door's unlocked to go into the living room, and right next to it, there's a little fridge. And in the fridge, there's beer. And I don't care if I've been out for 3 hours or 3 days, I get a beer. I drink. This is what I drink, no matter what. And I get a beer, and I drink the beer on the way upstairs. I get in bed next to my lovely wife. Maybe the bottle goes on the nightstand or on the floor, and I crawl into bed. Now, on a good night, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, I get up, I stagger around, and I walk into the closet. Maybe I find her boots. I pee in her boots or a trash can or something like that. And you too, right, T? Yeah, it's... And on a bad night, I wet the bed. I wet the bed, you know? You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a vision for you. I was. I mean, my wife was like, you got him. You don't even have to give him back. You know, I mean, it was bad. And that's what I brought to the party. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated it. And I heard all these people telling stories about throwing up. Everybody's throwing up. I never threw up. Ever. Ever. Never threw up. So I remember when I finally got a sponsor, I went about 100 days stark, raving, sober before I got a sponsor. And I'm having a conversation with my sponsor, and I'm telling him that I don't know if this is going to work for me. Everybody's talking about throwing up. I never threw up. These people don't even know how to drink. And he goes, oh, yeah, you are a much higher class alcoholic. There's no doubt. If I understand this correctly, you crap your pants with reckless abandon and alarming regularity. And you periodically wet the bed. I think you need to call AA World Services because we've been waiting for you. Yeah. So I'm in these meetings, and I'm going to them. And if you're new, I want to really make sure that you understand that I'm not an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't appointed. I wasn't anointed. I'm just the guy up here telling his story tonight. We're a society of storytellers. That's what we do. That's how we convey the message. And you're here to have your experience. Not mine, not your sponsors, not the person to your left or right, but your experience. And the way I got that experience is through the 12 steps. Now, I understand the third tradition. The third tradition is the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. So you don't have to work the steps. I tried that. It didn't work for me. I'm going to meetings, and I'm hearing well-intentioned people, and they're talking about meetings, meetings, meetings. Meeting makers make it. Just go to 90 meetings in 90 days, which I did. I went to probably 120, 150 meetings in 90 days. And people are talking about being restored to sanity. I feel like I'm going nuts. I mean, I'm sitting there, and people are talking, and I'm starting to hear a lot of white noise, and I can't pick up what's going on, and I'm getting progressively worse the longer I'm physically sober. And frankly, that convinces me more of my alcoholism today than anything that I did while drinking. Because the solution for me is not the removal of alcohol. This is a problem. For me, alcohol is God in a bottle, and I do not have a suitable substitution yet. And I am not happy. Now, there are people in the meetings that are talking about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They're talking about the program, which is the 12 steps. And they're talking about sponsorship. And they're talking about God. But, you know, I'm physically sober. I don't want to overreact here. You know, I don't want to get over sober. I'm not the kind of guy. I'm not an overachiever. I don't like bonus points. I don't like any of this. You know, I'm not a joiner. I don't like that. I just want to sit there and be better. And I'm sitting there, and I'm getting worse. And finally, I went on a business trip. I went back to St. Paul, Minneapolis, and then I went to Pittsburgh. And I'm in Pittsburgh, and I'm doing some depositions. I'm getting ready for a trial. And I'm supposed to be there all week. But I get done Wednesday or Thursday. I go back midday. I'm in the hotel room. And in the hotel room, I have an honor bar. An honor bar. You know, I'm a newcomer. I have no honor. But they've given me this little fridge with a key. I've got the key. And inside the fridge is what I need. And it's what I want. 2x2x2x2. There's bourbon, scotch, vodka, gin. No tequila, which pissed me off. But there was beer. Domestics, imports. You know, there was a good start in there, and I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink really bad. But I'd been around long enough to hear my story through you. I know it doesn't go well. I know what happens to me when I try to drink cognac. I'm the kind of guy, my wife sends me out to get milk, and I come back 3 days later. But I bring back the milk. I'm like, hey, baby, I got the milk. I don't understand the issue. She does. It's called alcoholism. I'm thinking, I'm a little time travel. What's the problem? You know, I don't get it. And so I'm in that hotel room, and I love the big book, and I love the 12 and 12, but one of my favorite things when I was new is my sponsor had me read a book and listen to some talks by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain, who just a little north of here, in I think 1975 or 76, he gave a series of talks in Palo Mesa. And they put it in a book, and it's called A New Pair of Glasses. There's six talks. And it's not AA-approved literature. It's just an alcoholic shares his experience, strength, and hope. But he talked to me, and I could hear him. And one of the things in his book is he has a drawing. It's a really simple drawing. It's a circle. And what Chuck does is he puts all the people, plants, and animals in the universe inside the circle of life, and then he puts good, God, love, whatever your concept of a higher power is, inside the circle of life. So everything's inside the circle of life. But to the left, he draws a stick man outside the circle. And that's Chuck, and that's me. And what separates us is a thin line that he identifies as ego or conscious separation from God. In the 11th step, we're trying to get conscious contact. But I'm new. I'm pacing back and forth in this hotel room. And I have conscious separation. Now, the reality is, there is no separation. But until I work the steps, I can't see the reality of that. And every alcoholic that I've ever talked to has this illusion of separation, this belief, which is not founded on fact, that somehow I'm different. I'm either better than or less than, but I'm not the same as Mark. It worked for Mark, but it won't work for me. It worked for Bill, but it won't work for me. It worked for George, but it won't work for me. And it's the ego trying to keep me drunk. And I'm sitting there in that hotel room, and I'm trying to distract myself. I'm pacing back and forth, and I'm opening and shutting the honor bar. You know, I'm inventorying it. You know, I want to know what's in there. And finally, I start watching TV to distract myself. I'm starting to flip channels from religious television to porno. Religious television to... Sir, you are really sick. You know, I'm not trying to judge, but you're this is you and I need help. And the bad thing is I'm getting confused as to who's doing what on what channel. I mean, it's not pretty. And finally I break down and I go inside the honor bar and I drink everything in the honor bar except the alcohol. You know, I start with the sugared soda. Then I drink the diet soda, I drink the fizzy water, I drink the flat water. I'm just out of my mind. I'm manic. I drank tonic water. That's right, sir, yeah. It serves no point without gin. It's kind of bitter. It's like bad tequila, but there's no end game. You don't get anywhere but pissed off. And I'm just, you know, and I don't know what happened. You know, you can call it the dumb luck of the alcoholic. Norm Alpe called it seconds and inches. I wouldn't have called it this at the time, but I believe it's the grace of God. I don't drink. I go downstairs. I get all my stuff, and I drive out to the airport, and I fly home. And I'm sober. Not happy, but I'm sober. And I fly home, and it's a long flight, and I'm new, and I'm a thinker. So I got a plan. And I get up the next morning. I'm going to execute my plan, and I'm thinking it's a brilliant newcomer plan. Before I got sober, I was in the Army for about 13 and a half years. I went through airborne school and ranger school, special forces training. They eventually sent me to law school. I've got a very high security clearance. And I'd acquired a bunch of things in the military. That when in 1993, I didn't turn them in. I didn't think of it as stealing. I just thought they might come in handy one day. And they were in a kit bag, what we call a go bag. And I had some weapons, I had some demo, and I had 13 passports. And they had my name on some of them, but not on all of them, in different countries, and I'd use these for God and country, and I just hadn't turned them in. And so I'm going through this. I'm not going to go Columbine with the weapons or the demo, and I've since gotten rid of everything, but I need the passports to execute this brilliant plan. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my blue tourist passport with my name and my photo on it, my real identity, and I'm going to fly to British Columbia. Once I get to British Columbia, I'm going to start flipping passports and identities. I'm going to head east. I'm going to go to Europe. Stay there for a couple weeks. Come back to British Columbia. Steve Lamb will cease to exist. And I got a wife and I got a kid. I don't think about them for a minute. I'm making a career change. They're not involved. You know, I don't want to bother them, right? You know? And I'm scared. And then when I get back to British Columbia, Steve Lamb ceases to exist. I've got some former associates of mine down in Costa Rica. They're doing some rather interesting marketing and distribution down there. And my newcomer plan is I'm going to join them. You know, it's just kind of a career change, right? And so I lay all this stuff out, and I'm inventorying it, and the 13 passports that I should have turned in 1993, they are current. They have not expired. But my blue tourist passport has expired. So I'm like almost in tears. Because it's important to leave on your name, and I can't leave on my name. Now, the pathetic thing is this, and this is an example why education is no benchmark for sobriety. Because I went to college. The Army sent me to law school at the University of Southern California. They sent me to get an LLM, a Master of Laws, right next to the University of Virginia. I am licensed to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. But that particular morning in 1996, I did not have the synaptic capability in my brain to realize it's pre-9/11. I could have flown up there on my driver's license. I didn't even need my passport. But I don't know this. I'm just beside myself, and I didn't know what to do, so I went to a meeting. And I'm at this meeting, and the guy who became my grand sponsor, Jim, didn't like Jim. Didn't like Jim at all. Jim, not a nice man. Jim talked about the big book and the steps and God and sponsorship. I didn't like that. And he, about 100 days stark raving sober, and he's talking about sponsorship. And I'm not sure if this is what he said, but what I thought I heard him say was, if you need help getting a sponsor, see me after the meeting. And I'm beside myself. I don't know what to do. So I walked up to him after the meeting because I figured, you know, it's time. And I looked at him right in the shoes. Because I couldn't look at him in the face. And I said, Jim, I heard you talking about sponsorship. I've been around about 100 days. And I thought it's time that I should interview for a sponsor. And he laughed, and he grabbed me by the shoulder, and he said, you are pathetic. Come with me. And he took me outside, and he introduced me to a guy named Michael. He said, Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsee, go with God. And he walked away, and he's laughing. And I'm thinking, this is not only not funny, it's not even slightly humorous. You know, because people have been saying, you know, if you want what we have, join us, and find someone who has what you want. And that should be your sponsor. Well, how do you do that if you don't interview them, right? And I got a complex set of social issues. I mean, not just anybody can sponsor me, right? I mean, you know, they got to be up for the task. And Michael isn't skipping a beat because he's got a new guy. He's all excited. I didn't realize that Jim sponsored Michael. And, you know, he's just trying to get a new guy to Michael. And Michael's excited. He reaches in his pocket. He gets out a card. He writes his name and his address and his phone number on the card. And he says, a couple questions that I like to ask the guys I sponsor. He says, do you have Big Book? And I'm looking at him, and my head's going a million miles a minute. And I'm not saying this, but I'm thinking, yeah, I got a Big Book. I'm not reading it with you. I don't even know who you are. I mean, this is just too weird. This too weird. I said, yeah. And I said, yeah, I got a Big Book. He said, you got a 12 and 12? And I'm thinking, I got a 12 and 12. I'm not reading it with this. I don't know this guy. He's younger than me. I've never heard his story. And by the way, he's got a lazy wandering eye. He just keeps, you know, drifting off. It's just kind of creepy. And I got to tell you, later on, we did sexual inventory. And he said, before the sexual inventory, we're going to invite God into the room. And he looked up there. And I looked too. Because I didn't know, you know. And I don't know this guy, right? And Michael says, good, you're going to need both your Big Book and your 12 and 12. Be at my house, 6:30, Monday night. And everything in my soul said, no, no, no. And I heard myself say, okay. And if you knew, that was my first step in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because I always knew I was powerless over alcohol. You've heard how I'm powerless over alcohol. But the whole unmanageability thing, I cannot accept until, even in the lame way I did it, I asked a man to sponsor me. So we sit down, we read the Big Book, we read the 12 and 12. He has me read ahead. I have to read to him. I'm a lawyer. I got to read to him when I get there. I don't realize the guy's a nuclear engineer, you know, but I'm reading to him. He's reading to me. He has me look up words that I thought I knew the meaning to, which I apparently don't. And he has me read the 12-12. We get to a prayer, we say the prayer. We get to a step, we work the step, and it saved my life. And I got to tell you, if you're new, I was absolutely convinced this would not work for me. And a lot of times people in Alcoholics Anonymous will say things like, Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want it. And then there's a whole other camp that will say, no, it's for people who need it. My experience is, it's for people who do it. Okay? It's for people who do it. Attitude is optional. That comes. I had the crappiest attitude. I questioned everything. I was not a good sponsee. I was not. We got to the second step, you know. Do I think a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity? Yeah, I've read ahead. I know what we're talking about God. I'm not stupid. We're talking about God. And there are old-timers, you know, there are guys like George and Bill that are telling me, you know, find God or die. And I'm thinking, I not only don't want to find God, I'm hoping he doesn't find me. You know, I did some bad stuff. Because I read ahead. I read ahead. I know there's a fourth and fifth step. There's eight and nine. This is going to go bad. You know, And I know what we're talking about. I know we're talking about God. He goes, yeah, well, we are. But you understand that in Alcoholics Anonymous, the word God appears over 100 times. But so does higher power, creative intelligence, universal mind. In Bill's story, he refers to God as my newfound friend, capital F. Now, these are words. If you have a religious background, we absolutely think you should continue with your religion. Do whatever you're doing. Whatever your religious or spiritual practice is, keep doing it. We just suggest that you overlay the 12 steps on top of it. And if you have a problem with religion, why don't you try to think of this word God as a placeholder for an experience you haven't had yet? How does that work? And I'm thinking, this guy's nuts. You know, I used to call my sponsor the Mystic Muffin, the Cosmic Cupcake. I mean, it was just God, 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 God. And I'm looking at him and he goes, well, do you think I've been restored to sanity? I said, yeah, you're doing pretty good. He goes, how about Jim? Yeah, Jim's doing well too. He says, how about you? I said, well, it's unlikely. He says, well, is it possible? I said, well, yeah, it's possible. He said, well, that's enough. So we're on to step three. Now I've got to turn my will and my life over to this thing that I don't understand. We're back here. It's, you know, I know, we're back. And come on, we're back at God. And he's like, look, here's the deal. Do you like music? I'm like, yeah, I like music. He says, would you agree everybody likes music? I said, yeah, I think everybody likes music. He said, what kind of music do you like? Well, I like blues and I like rock. He said, how would you like it if I tried to convince you that you need to like classical? It's okay, but I don't think, well, we don't do that in AA. See, God's like music. We just suggest you find what you like, that you find the rhythm and harmony that you're comfortable with, and that'll allow you to get in tune with the infinite. And I'm thinking, this guy has lost it. I mean, he's lost it. And he says, the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is God is everything in AA, but it's the easiest part. Because there's no creed, there's no manifesto, there's nothing to memorize. There's nothing to adhere to or follow. You deal with it the way you deal with it. I'm still not buying it. So we go to page 37 in the 12 and 12. And in 37 in the 12 and 12, there's something called the acid test. It goes like this. How is what you're doing working for you? I'm like, not too good. I'm sitting here talking to you. I mean, come on. Right? And he goes, well, why don't you try it our way? All right, well, I'll try it. I'm not believing it, but I'll try. He says, don't worry about that. The belief comes with the experience, which I didn't understand at the time. So I'm like, well, how do I know if I've done the third step? And he says, well, you know, a good general indication of having completed the third step, although you'll do it your entire life, is if you start a fourth step. Sponsors are tricky bastards. They really are. You know, so we go to the instructions in the big book. He points out page 65 and he says, you see those columns? I said, yeah. He said, you notice anything about those columns? No. He says, well, take a look at it. He says, what do you think? What do you see there? I'm like, well, that Mr. Brown's a real jackass. Somebody needs to tighten him up. He's got, no. He says, do you notice that you'll hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous, they'll talk about their life story. That's fine. There's lots of different ways to write inventory. There's all kinds of workbooks and all kinds of things. I don't want you to do your life story. I want you to follow the process in the big book. You'll notice that they're not even complete sentences. They're really bullet points. You don't need more than two or three words for each column. I want you to write who you're resentful at. The person, the principal, or the institution. What is the cause? In the third column, I want you to write how it affects you or the condition. Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, or sexual relations. That's all you got to write. What I'm calling the fourth column, he says, you'll see on page 67, it says, turning back to our list, we're going to look at it from a different perspective. We're going to look at mistake, fault, or blame. We're going to look at selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, dishonesty, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. And finally, on 66 and 67 in the bottom, are you unwilling to accept that the person you're resentful against could be spiritually sick? Are you unwilling to forgive in addition to fear? That's all you're going to do. And then you're going to write a fear inventory and a sexual misconduct inventory. And he gave me the instructions, and they're really simple, but as the book says, not easy. He told me it should take me a couple weeks. I think it took me 4 or 5 weeks. And I write out this inventory, and I'm going to, for the new person, I want you to really understand how simple this is. I'm going to tell you the first person on my inventory. I'll never forget it. It's pretty simple. It goes like this. I'm resentful at, two words, my father. Second column, the cause, two words, deserted me. Like it says in the big book, Michael's prepared for a long talk, so he asked me what happened. I tell him I'm around 4 or 5 years old. My father leaves. He goes to Vietnam. He doesn't come back. He does not die there. He was in the Air Force. He went over there. He did a couple tours there. He eventually joined an outfit called Air America. He stayed there, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. Met a Thai woman, married her, I think before he divorced my mom. And I've got a half-sister. And I hardly heard from my father for at least a decade. And very, very sporadically after that. He deserted me. What does it affect? Everything. Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sexual relations. It's a five-bagger. My life is shot through with it. What mistake, fault, or blame do I have? Well, in relation to the second column, the cause, I don't have any. I was 5 years old. This is like, you know, maybe the woman that was abused or raped or the kid that was abused. They don't have a mistake, fault, or blame in the cause. What about the condition? I'm 37 years old when I come into AA. I'm 38 by the time I'm writing this inventory. It's been over 3 decades I've got this resentment. What defect of character, if God were to remove it from me, would I no longer have this resentment, which is the number one offender that blocks me from God? Am I selfish, self-centered, self-seeking? I don't think so. Dishonest? No. Pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. I write down anger. I was really angry. Fear, a lot of fear. And the fear looks like this. I gave my father power, which I thought was love, and he abused it, so I can't let that happen again. There has to be a wall of insulation between me and you and you and me because it's not safe. It's just not safe. It's not safe for me. Now, that does not make for good marital relations or relations with, you know, people that I work with or friends or anybody, but it's all I got. And then finally, I'm unwilling to accept that he could be spiritually sick. I'm unwilling to forgive him. And I read this inventory to Michael. I'm getting ready to move on to the next person. And he goes, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I got some questions. I don't realize this is an interactive process. And he says, I want to make sure I understand this. You're resentful at your father, right? Yeah. Your residual anger? Yeah. A lot of fear? Yeah. And you don't want to forgive him, right? And I'm like, yeah, Michael, and I've read ahead. I know there's a ninth step. It's never happening. I'm never going to forgive him. And Michael looks at me and says, well, this is a program of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. But right now we're just reading the inventory, but we're going to get to that. But I have one more question. If I understand you correctly, the day you asked me to sponsor you, you had a plan. You were going to do this little geographic. You had something with passports. You were going to go to Costa Rica. And you're married and you got a kid. And I don't think you said you were going to desert him, but, I mean, is there really a difference between what you were going to do and what your father did? I did not say amen. My first thought was, oh, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all. Not at all. And I put my head down and I muttered something like, well, I mean, if you look at it that way, I mean, you know. And if you're new, that's one of the points of the fifth step. That's why we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Because I can't see me for who I am. I need this other person, Michael, to hold a mirror up to me, to reflect me back to me, so I can see me for who I am. If I can see me for who I am, maybe I can see you for who you are. If I can do that, then maybe I can realize we're all inside the circle of life. But I'm not happy about this. We go on. I read the rest of the inventory. I do the fear inventory, the sexual misconduct inventory. I go home and get quiet. I review it. Now I got to do 6 and 7. 6 is about willingness. 7 is about humility. I have very little of either. I make an 8-step list. I present it to Michael. I'm talking to him about it. He goes, your father's not on the list. I'm like, you're damn Skippy. I told you he wasn't going to be on the list. You know, pay attention, right? He goes, well, do you think you're any better than your father? I said, no, and thank you for pointing that out to me. He said, well, you've been having some problems with your wife. You're complaining about your wife about stuff, and, you know, there's a lot of relationship problems. Maybe if you were able to make amends with your father, maybe if you were able to forgive your father, it would get better. I'm like, theoretically, I understand that, but you don't understand. This isn't going to happen. He goes, well, the 8-step talks about praying for the willingness. Are you ready to pray for the willingness? I said, yeah, I'll pray for the willingness. Okay, you'll pray, I'll pray, we'll both pray. So we're praying, and I start making 9-step amends to the wife, pay back some money, things are going better, and I'm back in the big bed. I don't have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve, but, you know, things are going better. And I get into an active 10-step process. I'm doing 11-step. I'm praying and meditating every day. I'm getting this conscious contact. I start working with other guys. I'm sponsoring them. You know, I'm a man of God. I'm taking them to God. I mean, I'm practicing these principles in all my affairs. Everything's going well, but I'm not making amends to my father. And he points out to me, Michael says, well, you know, we read the Lord's Prayer at a lot of meetings. You say it a lot, right? I said, yeah. He says, what about that phrase, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us? What do you think that means? I'm like, I think that's a damn trick question. That's what I think that means. You know, it's good because it's a spiritual truth. It's a maxim. I'm only forgiven to the extent that I forgive. So I'm agreeing with him, but I still can't do it. And finally, we're praying, and, you know, I'm starting to soften a little bit, but this takes years, okay? And then I made a mistake. I told my sponsor I was going to go do some depositions up in Wasilla, Anchorage, Alaska, and he gets all excited because I had told him that my father lives in Wasilla, which is just outside of Anchorage. So Mike's like, this is great. You'll make amends to your father. I'm like, I did not get that memo. That's you know, you're connecting dots that don't exist. He goes, no, get quiet. You know, talk to God. I think, you know, I'm praying, you're praying, this is the answer. And it was the answer. And I told him, I said, I'll do it. But, you know, I need to know what to say to my father. He says, I don't know. I'm not going. Ask God. Oh, jeez, you know. So I'm praying, and I'm getting this. I'd really like some specific direction, and I'm not getting it. But I get this feeling that, you know what, if I do this, it'll be okay. I don't know how it'll be okay, but it'll be okay. I fly up there, and I go through the airport, and I see my father, and he's a lot older than I remember. He's shuffling towards me, and he's very hesitant. I, on the other hand, am walking towards him with purpose. I don't know what the purpose is, but I have made a commitment. I'm making amends. And I walk up to him, and when I got to him, I did one of the things that I hated when I first got to AA. I held him, and I hugged him, and he buried his head in my shoulder. And he sobbed for about 5 minutes. And forgiveness occurred, and all I had to do was show up. And none of this makes sense until you do it. None of this makes sense until you do it. And then, you know, things are better with a wife. I go home, you know, who knew? But I got to tell you, just to give you an idea what alcoholic thinking is like. I had a monster resentment against my wife. And it's going to sound really petty and ridiculous, but at the time it was huge. I got a couple years sober. I'm sponsoring guys. I'm praying. I'm meditating. I'm a man of God. And my wife does not appreciate all the hard work that I've put in. She doesn't. And the way this manifests itself is she takes the trash and recycling and she puts it on the stoop every night for me to take in the morning. Because apparently I'm the trash recycling guy. I know what this means. I have a Kreskin-like ability. I read minds. I know what's going on. You know, I go to Michael and I'm writing inventory. And he says, well, have you talked to her? I'm like, no, I haven't talked to her. Because I know. I'm a mind reader, too. I know how to mind read. And he goes, well, you could be wrong. No, I know. He says, well, look, you got to pray and meditate. You got to ask for direction. So I'm writing inventory. I'm like killing trees, writing inventory. And I'm praying and meditating. I'm asking for direction. And I hope for the newcomer. This takes about 8 or 9 months. And what comes to me is patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. And it's removed. I got patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I pick up trash recycling. Everything's good. I mean, I'm not writing any more inventory. Sometimes I pick it up. The more I twitch just a little bit, you know, but nothing big. You know, it's okay. This goes on for about 10 years. We get a dog. Dog poops. You know, I take her out and she does her business. I put it in a bag, put it in the trash. But at night when I go to a meeting, she poops. My wife puts it in a bag and sticks it with the trash and recycling on the stoop. So I've worked through trash recycling, but now I got dog crap, you know. I know what this means, right? writing more inventory. Michael says, well, have you talked to her? No, I haven't talked to her because I'm a mind reader. I know what's going on, and you don't know my wife. All right, you got to pray and meditate. I pray and meditate. I'm asking for direction. I get direction. Here's a direction. Patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. This only takes a couple weeks. Now I got no problem. Trash, recycling, poop. I'm good. Everything's cool, right? This goes on for 3 or 4 years. Last year, I go out the front door instead of the side door. I don't get the trash, recycling, and poop. I get to my office. I realize I haven't done it. I got to make amends. Before I go to my Monday night meeting, I'm having dinner with my wife and my kids, and I look at my wife. I say, hey, Lynn, I went out the front door instead of the side door. I apologize. I did not get the trash, recycling, and poop this morning. She goes, what? I go, well, you know, it's my job. You know, I'm supposed to get the trash, recycling, and poop every morning, and I went outside the front door instead of the side, didn't get it. I apologize. I'll try to be better. She goes, what? So I've been taught to pause when agitated. But, you know, I mean, it's one thing to have to do it, but not to get credit for it. I mean, come on, you know. So I'm like, okay, you know, so I'm gonna speak slowly. Okay, you know, the trash, recycling, and poop, baby. I've been doing it for over a decade. I know it's my job, you know, and I didn't do it, and I apologize. And she looks at me and goes, I don't know what you're talking about. She says, you know we have possums and raccoons and skunks out in the back there, and I don't go where the trash recycling bins are? I don't put that there on the stoop for you. I just figure I'll put it there, I'll get it in the morning. Or the girls will get it or you'll get it, but I don't put it there for you. So I'm not that quick, but it dawns on me that I've been working through a resentment for over a decade that has no basis in fact. So I look at her and go, I love you, babe. Gotta go. And, I go to the meeting and I get to the meeting. And I'm, you know, Bill C's there, my sponsor's there, and I'm, you know, I'm telling these guys, telling old timers, you know, like Bill and George, and they think it's hilarious. They think it's hilarious. They're like calling every, hey, listen to what Lamb did. You can't believe this, you know. And my sponsor says, you know, Lamb, that's why they call it a delusion. Because a lot of times in AA, you hear people get up here and they'll talk about denial. But the big book doesn't talk about denial. It's not we don't suffer from denial, but denial is a treatment and a rehab term. Delusion is the AA term. And there's a difference. Denial is I know the truth, but I don't like it. I like the lie. I want you to buy the lie. Delusion is I did not get the memo. I don't know. I operate under this false reality for over a decade. And Michael says, well, there's good news and bad news. Okay. What's the bad news? He says, the bad news is it never ends, man. It never ends. I said, well, what's the good news? He said, the good news is welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's always something to do, and there's always somebody to do it with. And if you don't have that person, I hope you find who's done. Thanks for having me here.